Everyone is getting settled. I'll again call the case. It's Robert Nord versus Catherine Bowers, A23-1644. As all counsel are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally, counsel for the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level. The podium does go up and down. And just when you begin, please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is William Lubov. I represent Catherine Bowers, the appellant in this proceeding. Your Honors, it is most simply and accurately stated that Judge Satterbach failed in her responsibility to review the proposed petition for dissolution, consider its facts, and determine whether to sign the document or schedule a hearing before entry of the judgment and decree. If the judge even read the petition before signing it, the judge would have known
the
following.
Excuse me, can you talk up just a little bit?
Certainly.
Yeah, thanks.
I'm seldom suggested that I speak too
softly. I like soft-spoken people myself. But, yeah.
Shout it out, Mr. Lubov.
Thank you. If the judge even read the petition before signing it, the judge would have known the following. The appellant has been married for in excess of 20 years. The appellant is unemployed and is on Social Security disability, receiving only $770 per month in benefits. And the respondent earns over $65,000 per year. Yet the judge signed a judgment and decree waiving spousal maintenance. Pursuant to Minnesota statute.
That was provided by both parties under a joint petition, right?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay. So based on that, what would have given the judge the heads up that, oh my God, this is a problem? You know.
Judge, you were a trial judge before.
I was.
A long time ago.
And I did read things even if both parties signed them. But based on this, I'm not so sure. Oh my God, well, let's schedule a hearing. There's clearly fraud going on. I mean, nothing on the petition on its face would have given me that heads up, Mr. Lubov.
Well, I respectfully take issue with that comment, Your Honor, and let me explain why. Actually, in reverse order, the Pooley case talks about the state of Minnesota sitting as a third party to ensure that the outcome is fair and reasonable. The Karen case talks about the duty the court has to protect the interests of both parties to ensure that the stipulation is fair and reasonable. And in this particular case, and the Bolenbach decision requires both parties to make a full disclosure of assets. Had the judge scheduled the matter for hearing, and I'm now, I guess, renewing my comment that you having served as a trial judge, obviously had an opportunity on many occasions to consider the issue of spousal maintenance and family law proceedings.
On that point, the not scheduling a hearing, you don't cite any authority that the judge was duty bound to schedule a hearing.
Actually, I did, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, okay.
518.13. That provides that the court shall schedule a hearing if there is an issue as to whether or not the judgment and decree or proposed judgment and decree is fair and reasonable.
So first you have to get past the hurdle that Judge Conley's talking about. In order, i.e. that the judge should have seen that on its face, it didn't look fair.
Yes.
And then the judge would have to schedule a hearing.
Absolutely.
But if the judge doesn't get past that first piece.
And I say I am long in tooth in the practice of law. I have over 48 years of practice, and throughout my practice, I have, as part of that, worked in the area of family law. And I have never seen a situation where an individual who is unemployed and unemployable by virtue of the Social Security disability determination, receiving only a $770 benefit per month, whereas the other party is fully employed and are earning significantly greater. I have never seen a court go so far as not to question the fairness or reasonableness of such a position of waiving spousal
even
payments.
Based on a marriage that lasted 4 months?
Excuse me?
How long? Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. So you're saying the marriage lasted 20 years?
Yes.
Okay. And you're saying that would have given a presumption that there should have been maintenance?
It certainly was a presumption, but it certainly, even more importantly, evokes the notion that I need to get some questions answered before I enter a judgment and decree for an individual receiving Social Security disability. If the court would have scheduled a hearing, and I might note also in the Pooley case that I cited, in that case, the court actually held a hearing as required under 518.13. Now, in this case, had the court scheduled a hearing, it would have heard the following information, because this has been, by virtue of the affidavits filed in the motion to reopen, this information came to the fore. He would have been made aware that the appellant has suffered from mental illness, OCD, PTSD, and borderline personality order since 2013.
But those weren't the issues that brought her before the, I'll call it the commitment court. It was a psychotic break that brought her there, not OCD, PTSD, or borderline personality.
Well,
I read the record.
Well, okay, I was going to get there, but I'll get there right now. I have worked in the area of commitment law for over four decades.
When you, in fact, were her lawyer.
I was her lawyer in the commitment proceeding. That's how I became aware of this situation. And as a prelude, to the extent that you are not experienced in commitment law, I don't know one way or another, there is a requirement under Minnesota statute that a pre-petition screening unit does an initial investigation and makes a recommendation to the county attorney's office as to whether or not the county attorney should proceed with a petition for commitment. And the pre-petition screening unit found that, let me get to my notes.
Wait, I think you included that in your addendum.
I did.
Yeah.
I did. That my client, the appellant, had an organic disorder of brain or substantial psychiatric disorder of thought, mood, perception, orientation, and memory, which grossly impairs her judgment, reason, understanding, or sense of reality. And on that basis, and upon that recommendation, made a recommendation of the county attorney to proceed, and in fact, she ultimately was civilly committed. But we have something more direct even than the pre-petition screening report and their inquiry. We have the affidavit of the respondent in this proceeding, wherein he said that within more than several weeks before the judge ever signed this judgment and decree, that, let me get to his quote.
And can you tell us the paragraph or page you're on, please?
I'm on page one of my notes.
I'm sorry, I don't have
nothing more authoritative than that for the moment.
But is it in the addendum?
It is in the addendum.
The affidavit of...
of the respondent.
Of the respondent.
Starts at page 44.
Yep.
And he said at that point in time that in mid-November...
where are you now?
Once again, I'm only referring to my notes.
Okay.
But it is contained within the affidavit of the respondent, and I did cite it in my brief. She was evidencing bizarre behavior, including delusions and signs of paranoia.
Well, wait a minute now. I'm looking at paragraph 14. Each of us executed the joint petition. Catherine was not showing any signs of paranoia or psychosis at the time of signing. She was stable, coherent, logical, and happy with her decision to finalize the doors with the related settlement. She expressed excitement about the prospect of leaving for Las Vegas. Where? Okay, and then is it the next one on October 29th? Well, then she goes to Las Vegas, and then a few days after her arrival in Vegas, she flies back. And then in mid-November 2022, she flies back. And it was only then that I began noticing Catherine experiencing bizarre behavior, including decisions and signs of paranoia. I mean, that is that what, I mean, that's consistent with the respondent's argument that nothing was known prior to the joint petition being signed.
It's absurd that nothing was known, but let me return to my argument for a minute to address that question. At the hearing—
Well, it's not absurd. As I read the record, she goes to Las Vegas, then she flies to Chicago to meet with the man that she met online, and it was then with THC in Las Vegas and maybe what the man gave her that she then returns home psychotic.
That is correct. But do not ignore the fact that she already had been diagnosed and awarded Social Security disability benefits. And the issue here—
OCD, PTSD, and borderline personality, but probably OCD and PTSD.
Yes. And the borderline personality disorder is supported and described in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual at 301.83 as a pattern of instability in interpersonal relationships and marked impulsivity.
I spent 7 years in juvenile court and read a lot of psych evals.
Had a hearing been held, if I might return to that, the judge would have been made aware that the appellant has suffered from mental illness since 2013. And he knew that the appellant was in the throes of a serious mental health crisis, which resulted in appellant's hospitalization and civil commitment. He had an affirmative obligation to let the court know that there had been a change in circumstances, even if he claimed that she was stable at an earlier date, for the court to consider whether or not the waiver of spousal maintenance was reasonable or appropriate under the circumstances. That constitutes, under the statutes, 518.145, subdivision 2, parts 1 and 3, fraud or misrepresentation upon the court. That would have justified the reopening of the proceeding at that point. He also knew that he was profiting, in essence, by this waiver of spousal maintenance for an individual who has no reasonable likelihood in the foreseeable future of being employable and being able to fend for herself financially. But unfortunately, Judge Satterback didn't connect the information that was already set forth in the petition for dissolution by the parties of what her mental health condition was, what her employment condition was, and what her ability was to provide for her own well-being. And in any reasonable consideration of this matter of spousal maintenance by the trial court, the court would inquire and expect proposed budgets, proposed living expenses, the ability to pay, the need for spousal maintenance under 518.552 relative to spousal maintenance. The court—
You're getting low on time. I have a question. Moving to a different issue, and that's assets. You argued that she had a non-marital interest in the party's home and that husband had workers' comp and personal injury claim.
Yes.
I couldn't find record evidence for that.
You're absolutely right. And there was no record of that was brought up at the time of the motion. I visited with my client to find out what were the circumstances of the divorce. I asked what had taken place, and she basically, I'm not intending to go outside the record, I'm just letting you know that there were no documents submitted to the court relative to budgets. There were no documents submitted to the court relative to ability to pay. All we had was this bare bone approach, which any reasonable fact finder would need before making a determination as to whether or not spousal maintenance was appropriate and needed under the circumstances. Judge Connolly, I I saw your lips.
You know, I am going to exercise, you know, my supreme power as presiding judge to ask one more question, even though your time is almost up. I mean, what the judge was presented with were the affidavit of your client and affidavits of other family members. And the other family members all seem to suggest she was not experiencing any mental episodes when she signed the joint petition. In looking solely at Ms. Bauer's affidavit, I mean, page, you know, on 37 of the appellant's addendum, you know, I am on Social Security disability and I receive $770 a month. I mean, I would have, in order to put the judge on notice, I would have been expecting to see something, and the disability is, you know, related to my mental health. The only other thing in the entire petition that references this is when she says, when the joint petition was executed, I was having severe mental health problems, and a petition for judicial commitment was filed on December 8th, 2022. So that's the only thing in the affidavit that was presented to the judge that sort of contradicts the affidavit saying that all of this behavior occurred, you know, when she came back from Las Vegas. So, and the case law is clear that, you know, the judge has to resolve things based on the affidavits. So why was it error to look at all the affidavits from other family members that seem to contradict her affidavit?
I want to answer your question by asking a question.
Go right ahead.
Your Honor, as a judge presented with contrary or conflicting information about the ability of the individual to provide for him or herself or to be responsible for payment, if there is an issue, which there is here, about her ability to understand, her ability to contract, her ability to move forward without financial support, what's the remedy for that? The remedy is under 518.13, schedule the damn hearing and get it out on the table, find out what everybody has to say, and make some specific facts, which would include, I would imagine, any judge to expect that the parties would submit information, financial information, to fill out the record. Thank you.
Thank you, and you will have rebuttal, Mr. LaBeouf. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel. Present with me this morning is also my client, Robert Nord, and my colleague, Teresa Bercande. I just want to point out, I understand zealous advocacy, but what I'm not a real big fan of is trying to confuse the court with facts. Like, for example, that the appellant was deemed to be disabled for Social Security purposes, when I think the court understands that was because of a PTSD and OCD and possibly borderline personality. There's no evidence that her disability was ever related to some cognitive dysfunctions, schizophrenia, paranoia.
Excuse me, are you a psychiatric expert? Doesn't mental illness, don't the symptoms vary?
They do. I think.
I mean, don't. Okay. So continue on with your argument, but please restrict yourself to what's actually in the record.
And that's what I'm absolutely trying to do. Is there was a determination of what her Social Security disability was based on, and just because somebody is found to be so disabled for Social Security purposes because of a mental health condition, doesn't mean they're prohibited from ever entering into a contract or a stipulated agreement.
But when she is found to have psychotic symptoms, only a couple of weeks after she signs this, shouldn't that be some kind of a tip-off? I mean, what was the harm? What would be the harm in having a factual hearing? It does strike me as unusual after a 20-year marriage that there wouldn't, and one spouse is employed, the other one is on Social Security disability, that there wouldn't be some discussion of spousal maintenance.
And that's a good question, Your Honor. I think there's no law that prevents parties from as they did in this case, agreeing that there was going to be no spousal maintenance, to waive spousal maintenance. There was a finding they both believed that they were going to be able to generate sufficient income to meet their reasonable monthly expenses. The plan on the appellant was to, she had a plan to move to Las Vegas. She believed she was going to be able to be gainfully employed in the hospitality industry. The parties negotiated a division of assets over a couple month period where they were negotiating the division of marital assets and debts, which included the parties doing a refinance for $20,000, which the appellant believed was going to be sufficient for her to be able to establish herself in Las Vegas and that she was going to be able to be gainfully employed. She believed that was the case. She was entirely within her rights to decide that she did not want spousal maintenance, that she believed that she was being awarded sufficient property, and that she wanted to conclude this divorce. She had a plan and she wanted to move forward with that.
But I mean, that, following up on Judge Siegel's excellent questions, I mean, speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, I think your strongest argument is the standard review. And I think there is a lot of evidence that would suggest, based on the affidavits, that she was of sound mind when she made this. However, you know, mental illness doesn't just come on like a light switch. And this whole plan of moving to Las Vegas to be a bartender, and doing all this, I'm not a psychologist. That looks like pretty manic behavior to me. And indeed it was, because a month later, this plan, I mean, as if there are no bartenders in Minnesota. I mean, you know, I don't really get why the whole trip to Vegas was crucial, but, you know, wasn't, if, and again, as Judge Siegel pointed out, a 20-year marriage, you know, no maintenance, that seems a little odd. And if you combine that with sort of the, you know, perhaps not the most articulated record of mental illness, but wasn't it an abuse of discretion for the court not to have a hearing to say, okay, there seems to be a big factual dispute as to what her mental health was pre-petition versus post-petition. Let's roll this in and get some experts here and, you know, see what's going on. I mean, wasn't that an error? I mean, these are pretty bad facts.
Your Honor, I do want to point.
I mean, it'd be one thing if, like, okay, you know what? I'm on my own now. We're out of here. I'm of sound mind. You know, that's that. But here, it's problematic, in my opinion.
I do also want to point out to the court that I know opposing counsel represented the appellant at the commitment hearing, and there's been some representations made to the court that she was civilly committed. That's not the way I read the order. My understanding of the order is that the commitment was stayed based on the appellant's agreement to follow certain conditions, and she was never civilly committed. And I think it's, it's especially since opposing counsel represented her in this hearing to represent to the court that she was actually civilly committed when that wasn't the case is a misrepresentation of the record.
She has to be a danger to herself or others to actually be civilly committed. And for the commitment court to exercise jurisdiction, there's something going on there. So let's just assume that as a basic fact.
And the court also found that she was competent to enter into the stipulation. And the whole basis of this commitment hearing is she was experiencing some kind of psychosis, and she admitted in her pre-screening, she said, the reason that I'm having this psychosis is because I purchased vape products in Las Vegas that I've been using on a regular basis, and that's why I'm experiencing this paranoia. It wasn't until she went to Las Vegas, purchased these vape products, that this psychosis was brought on for the brief period of time.
So this was marijuana that she was vaping?
Vaping.
Now legal in the state of Minnesota.
It is legal, but the various levels of THC, when there's a high content of THC, it's a very well-known fact that it can bring on issues of psychosis. And that's what she attributed herself, that the issue she was having was related to this. And it seems it has subsided since she stopped using.
But wasn't there an obligation of your client in the joint petition to at least put in some history of her mental illness, to full disclosure? I mean, if there was, then I think it's a different case, because then it's like, okay, everyone's on notice. She still wants to do this. That's that. And then there would have been no argument that, well, you know, the court could have had a hearing and said, well, wait a minute, you know, before I just sign off on that, I'm gonna talk to these people. Was there any indication in the joint petition that she suffers from mental illness?
There was not.
Okay,
Your Honor. And I think you are correct that if there was a history of schizophrenia, paranoia, psychosis, and that she was exhibiting signs of that type of behavior at the time the joint petition was signed, he would have absolutely had an obligation. Now the courts.
I'm looking at the joint petition, the bottom of page 10 of the addendum, and that's where she was her source of income. And it's Social Security Retirement, Survivors or Disability Income, RSDI, do not include SSI. And that's 770 there. But it was SSI, right?
It was Social Security Disability. But if there's some sort of, it's being implied that Mr. Nord had some sort of obligation when this petition was resubmitted to notify the court. The reason the petition was resubmitted was because there was some confidential financial information in it. The court wants that redacted. That was redacted. None of the terms in the stipulation were changed. It was not re-signed. And there's no evidence, and my client has told me, and I'll just represent it as an officer of the court, that when that was resubmitted, he wasn't aware that the appellant was having any cognitive issues. She was just coming back into Minneapolis at the time and had not been showed any signs of this type of behavior. Things got really bad the end of November, beginning of December. That's when the civil commitment issue started up. So he wasn't aware of it. He wasn't aware of any of these behaviors. What the court does have and what was presented was substantial information that the appellant was acting of sound mind around the time this agreement was negotiated. There's nothing in the record that she did not have the ability to go meet with a lawyer, or anybody prevented her from going to meet with a lawyer. She was actively working with the Anoka County Family Help Desk, getting these forms, asking them if they saw any red flags or issues that would prevent the judge from signing off on this agreement. She really wanted this agreement signed so she could move on with her life. And the judge, you noted that, you know, going to Vegas kind of seems like not a rational decision. My client has told me the appellant has always loved Las Vegas. She's loved to travel there, and it was sort of her dream job to be able to go out there and work in the hospitality industry. And there's a lot of opportunities for somebody that's a bartender in Las Vegas, and that she was looking forward to moving forward with that part of her life. She planned her move to Las Vegas. The parties worked out doing a refinance on their home so she could get the money to allow her to do that. Her children saw that she was happy with the decision, that she wanted the divorce. Her own two children did affidavits saying that she was of complete sound mind and understood everything she was doing at the time she did this. She did not want spousal maintenance. She was getting money from this refinance and other property. The assertion that the 401k was omitted from the decree, it's part of the decree. The appellant just got additional property to compensate for that. The question about this personal injury settlement, it was never resolved at the time of the party's divorce, and it still isn't resolved. So reopening the judgment and decree, the court wouldn't be able to address this issue because it hasn't been, that case has not been resolved, and there's no certainty it will ever be resolved. So there has been, the burden, the appellant had the burden here at the trial court to show by a preponderance of evidence that there was sufficient grounds to reopen this judgment and decree, and she cited two grounds to do that, all right? Unforeseen circumstances and fraud on the court. Those were the only two things she asserted. That were the only two grounds. She submits a two-page affidavit to the court. That's all the court had the basis on. The court found she did not meet her burden. Okay. Her burden now on appeal is to show that based on what she presented to the court, that there was a clear abuse of discretion by the judge. And I don't think she can overcome that standard based on what she presented and the fact that there's significance evidence that was presented by Mr. Nord that she was of sound mind when she signed these agreements, that it wasn't until after she returned to Las Vegas that these issues came on. That's the critical issue. What was her state of mind when she signed? There was not unforeseen circumstances. There's not been fraud on the court. There is no reason to.
If I could excuse you just for interrupt just for a minute. So Mr. Luboff has been arguing that, well, if nothing else, at least the court should have ordered a hearing to find out what was going on. So what is your response? Is 518.13 subdivision 5 the right place for us to look? Then is the standard the interests of justice? How do you respond to that part of Mr. Luboff's argument?
I think when parties execute a joint decision, as long as everybody was of sound mind, and I believe they were, and their parties are entirely within their rights to waive spousal maintenance under the law. If they're dividing the other property in a fair and equitable
I was trying to get at specifically the question of whether what legal standard we're to look at of whether the district court should have at least held an evidentiary hearing before denying the motion.
I think that's putting a significant burden on the court to be the gatekeeper when adults decide for good reason that they want to waive maintenance.
But what do we look at? Do we look at 518.13? And if so, what's the standard there?
I think we look at it, it was an abuse of discretion in the court in this case not to hold an evidentiary hearing when no hearing was ever requested by the parties. And no hearing was even requested in the post-decree motion to reopen for an evidentiary hearing. There was never any request. And based on what the trial court saw in the mutual waiver of the parties, my representation is competent adults are able to say they are waiving spousal maintenance if they believe that there's been an equitable division of property. She was being awarded this additional money from this refinance to $20,000. There can be a buyout of maintenance, and parties can say they are satisfied with that. And I believe we each have the ability in the future, which she did believe, to be self-supporting. Bartenders in Las Vegas can make a lot of money. And she believed that. She wanted to do it. She was of sound mind at that time. And therefore, I do not believe the court abused its discretion or not holding an evidentiary.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Siegel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Luboff, you'll have the last word.
Mr. Luboff, I want to focus on the judge's order.
Yes.
In particular, I'm looking at findings of fact 14 and 16. 14 is that the court does not find your client's assertion that she's having severe mental health problems to be credible, and you know it's hard for this court to look at credibility determinations. Second thing is, court finds that she was not exhibiting mental health issues until several weeks after the joint petition was executed. And I realize this is a compound question, but I just want you to address what I'm looking at in the order. And then the third one comes under the legal analysis, conclusions of law. And the judge noted that neither party requested an evidentiary hearing regarding whether this matter should be reopened. So I'm
not sure what
so were the, what's are the first two clearly erroneous? I mean, yes. That's our view on factual findings, mm-hmm. our standard of review. Mm-hmm. And as I said, we are loath to wade into credibility determinations and find them clearly erroneous. And then the second question is a legal one, that neither party requested a hearing.
The horse had left the barn. We were dealing with a post-decree motion. Our request for a hearing would have been more appropriate before the decree was ever entered under 518.13. That is precisely why the court, in three different ways, the court has a duty to ensure fairness and reasonableness. They have a duty under 518.33. They have a duty, according to the Karen case, a duty to protect the interests of the parties. And under the Pooley case, they have a duty that the state sits as a third party to ensure fairness and reasonableness. And this notion that an individual on Social Security disability who is unemployed, we have no test as to the information of what her employment history was by virtue of any record before the court, before the court entered a judgment and decree.
I understand your argument. I am wanting to know in the findings of fact in that order denying the motion.
Yes.
Which ones you find clearly erroneous?
Well, certainly I find this notion of the finding that her claim regarding mental illness is in doubt, or she doesn't believe.
Not credible. Yeah.
she has to go through an involved process to qualify for Social Security disability. And I might point out, I want to connect this for a second to Las Vegas and being a bartender. As we all know, there are limitations on income in order to preserve your SSDI benefits. And so whether she's in Minnesota or Las Vegas, she is always in danger of losing her Social Security disability benefits should she earn income in excess of the requirements under SSDI.
Would that be a reason for her to waive her spousal maintenance rights then?
Your Honor, when I started out my presentation having to do with judges in the arena of family law, I have on multiple occasions over the years seen judges say, wait a second. I need more information before I'm going to take any further action on this. If you're saying that there were negotiations, if you're saying that there were spreadsheets, if you were saying that there were proposed budgets, I want to see those. I want to see some evidence that ever took place, that there was an actual negotiation. We're talking about an individual who has been determined to be disabled. And the notion that the court took no action faced with that information set forth in the petition itself, by its very nature, constitutes an abuse of discretion that the court must correct in this proceeding. I don't know if I answered your question. I tried my best, but
yeah, no, that's fine. But and I took your response before that there was no separate request or specific request to the district court that at least give us a hearing and
right.
let us prove what we're saying.
Just, we need to go back to square one was the request. The notion of, you raised the question about civil commitment. I want to just address that real quick. A stay of commitment means you're under the jurisdiction of the court. Whether and the only escape clause is to comply with the conditions. Otherwise, you're going to be fully committed. So being under the stay of commitment is still a determination by the court that you meet the qualifications of the statute or the requirements of the statute, that you pose a danger to yourself or to others. And by virtue of a history, a long history of OCD, PTSD, and borderline personality disorder, there was a well-known track record to the respondent that he had an obligation to tell the court what's going on and say, I don't know whether that means anything or not, but I have to give you this information to support the notion of a waiver of spousal maintenance for a disabled individual. Hopefully I answered your question, Judge Riley.
You know how we review these orders, findings of fact for clear error, and then the conclusions of law separately. But so I was just wondering which of the findings of fact.
Well, that's
back at your brief and trying to figure out specifically.
Okay. I don't have any time remaining. So,
if you want to answer that question, we'll give you the time.
Excuse me?
If you wanted to answer that question, we will give you the time, Mr. Lubon.
I've done my very best to do so.
Fair enough. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Luboff. Thank you, Mr. Siegel. The matter is submitted. We'll be issuing our decision within 90 days. That being our last live oral argument of the morning, we are adjourned.